Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Frank Clemente of Americans for Tax Fairness, who assesses how the two versions of Republican tax reform legislation, which have passed in both the House and Senate, will impact working families and the U.S. economy. Pedro Cruz with the Sierra Club's Labor and Economic Justice Program, who talks about the challenges climate activists face in working with labor unions to build a clean energy future. And Steven Renderos of the Center for Media Justice, who discusses the FCC's plan to repeal net neutrality and a nationwide campaign opposing that action, which will disproportionately impact marginalized communities. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Trump administration is deploying hundreds of military advisors to Afghanistan as part of a renewed campaign against the insurgent Taliban. There are now 14,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan, up from 8,400 soldiers there at the end of the Obama administration in January 2017. The Pentagon has also ramped up the U.S. bombing campaign targeting the Taliban. A new military strategy announced by Commander General John W. Nicholson calls for deploying advisors with Afghan Army units and taking part in patrols with the aim of retaking Taliban territory. Only 60% of Afghanistan is now under government control. The level of U.S. airstrikes in Afghanistan is the most intense since 2010, resulting in a spike in civilian casualties. Still, Taliban attacks against Afghan army bases have resumed in Kandahar province. Human rights monitors have also raised concerns about a new local Afghan police force, which relies on local militias to stabilize areas cleared of insurgents. The former European Union representative to Afghanistan, Emily Winterbotham, observed, "The key issue in Afghanistan is that the government is either non-existent or illegitimate in the eyes of significant parts of the population." Weeks before Hurricane Maria ravaged Puerto Rico, 100 lawyers crammed into a federal courtroom in San Juan to debate the restructuring of $75 billion in Puerto Rico's debt. The lawyers represented various groups of bond investors, hedge funds, and vulture funds. The next scheduled hearing on October 4th was canceled by federal judge Laura Taylor Swain due to the island's humanitarian crisis. Debt repayment is now seen as unrealistic in the wake of estimates that the island suffered $45 billion to $95 billion in hurricane damage. There's a long history behind the island's brutal economic crisis. In the late 1990s, President Bill Clinton phased out tax breaks that made the island attractive to manufacturing and pharmaceutical companies. As corporations lost tax benefits, they left, taking away thousands of jobs. In response, the Commonwealth government used a special tax break from the 1917 Jones Act, which allowed Puerto Rico to issue bonds triple free of taxation. One of the big beneficiaries was Donald Trump's golf club in Puerto Rico, which received $25 million in financing. 2 years ago, the club declared bankruptcy. Before the 2008 global economic collapse, Puerto Rico ran out of money, furloughed 95,000 workers, and temporarily closed 1,500 schools. Even as Donald Trump continues to stoke the nation's culture wars, evangelical Christians are losing followers and experiencing a growing generational divide. Younger evangelicals are distancing themselves from doctrine they perceive as divisive, like that which condemns same-sex marriage. According to the Public Religion Research Institute, only 11% of evangelicals are under 30. Over the last decade, the Southern Baptist Convention, a leading voice for conservative Christians, has lost over 1 million members. Among the U.S. population, the percentage of evangelical Protestants fell to 16% over the last 10 years. Many traditional evangelical leaders are sticking with a hard line on social issues. For example, many evangelicals have rallied behind Alabama Republican U.S. Senate candidate Roy Moore, despite multiple and corroborated allegations of sexual molestation of underage and teenage girls. Christopher Driscoll, visiting professor of religion studies at Lehigh University, told the Christian Science Monitor that it's important to understand the context of the evangelical decline within the broader political climate ushered in by Donald Trump's presidency that's promoting white nationalism. American politics is turning again to a model of white life premised on fear of the other, border walls, Muslim bans, etc. The fear of white decline is on the minds of more than the far right, who speak of outright white genocide. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Now that the Republican-controlled House and Senate have both passed their different versions of tax reform legislation, a conference committee is tasked with reconciling the differences between the two bills, after which the measure will be brought back to both chambers for a final vote. Although President Trump and congressional Republicans predict that they'll succeed in final passage and have their tax bill signed into law by the end of the year, public opinion polls reveal that the measure is overwhelmingly unpopular. A recent Gallup poll found that 56% of those surveyed disapproved of the tax bill, while only 29% supported it. At least one Nobel Prize-winning economist has labeled the GOP tax bill the biggest scam in U.S. history. And according to various objective analysis, the bill would hurt most Americans, with the only big winners being the wealthiest 1%. That's because the core of the legislation transfers wealth from low-income and middle-class families to corporations and business owners. What's worse, due to the elimination of various deductions in the bills, almost two-thirds of middle-class taxpayers will find themselves subject to significant tax increases. The Republican tax plan could also trigger an automatic $25 billion cut to Medicare, because of a steep rise in the federal deficit. Your reporter spoke with Frank Clemente, executive director of Americans for Tax Fairness, who assesses how the two versions of Republican tax reform bills will impact working families and the U.S. economy.
Well, I'd say there's three big things to think about in the tax legislation. One is how much of the tax break is going to wealthy people, especially people, you know, the top 1%, we say. Those are people who make, depending on who's doing the estimating, anywhere from $500,000 to $700,000 a year in taxes. So they're pretty much, they're millionaires. The Senate bill that just passed, about 60% or so is going to those folks in 2027 when this thing is fully implemented. And in the House, it's about half. So, you know, they're sort of close. A little bit more is going to the rich on the Senate bill. The second big thing is sort of what happens with middle-class families, folks in the middle. As you know, the administration, the Trump administration, Republicans in Congress are promoting it as a major tax break for middle-income people. And what you find in the Senate bill about once this thing is fully implemented, again, after 10 years, you kind of got to look at certain things expire along the way. 87 million people, about half middle-income people, are going to be paying more in taxes under this plan. In the House, it's about 40 million people. So they tout it as being a huge middle-class tax break, but for, you know, tens of millions, up to 87 million people, it actually will be a tax increase once the tax breaks are fully phased in and the tax increases are fully phased in. Another big thing to think about is what happens to the corporate tax rate. And basically, both bills are very similar to how they treat big corporations. That is where most a big chunk of the revenue is lost in these bills. And in the Senate bill, about half of the tax break goes to businesses and corporations, and three-quarters of the tax break in the House bill goes to them. So you can see roughly the shape of these things are pretty similar. They're both giving big tax breaks to the people at the top. The reason most of the tax breaks go to the people at the top is because most of the tax breaks go to businesses and corporations, and those are the people who tend to own corporate stock. They get dividend payouts from corporations, or they own what are called pass-through businesses, law firms, doctor's offices, accounting firms, even Donald Trump. The Trump Organization has 500 pass-through businesses. Pass-through businesses are businesses that don't pay taxes at the corporate tax rate. They pay taxes at the individual tax rate. So essentially the profits flow through to the owners, and they pay them as individuals, not as corporations. So they get big, big tax breaks in this bill. So both of these pieces of legislation are very heavily tilted towards the wealthy and to corporations.
Frank, I wanted to ask you about the debt. Estimates are that this tax reform bill, in one version or the other, will bring about $1.5 trillion in debt to the United States. And there are those out there who believe the Republicans are consciously and purposely ramping up the debt so they can justify deep cuts to federal programs, social safety net programs, entitlement programs like Medicare and Social Security and the like. What could you say about the debt and it being used as really a Trojan horse to justify major cuts to federal programs?
Yes, well, we feel their agenda right now is to give big tax breaks to the wealthy and corporations, you know, to a lot of their donors. But they will come back. We've talked about this constantly with our work. Republicans were fine to not worry about the deficit this year because they wanted to give away huge trillions of dollars in tax breaks. They will turn around next year without any embarrassment, any shame, and they will say, well, all of a sudden, because of the tax cuts we passed last year, the deficit now isn't 75% of gross domestic product. It's now 90% of gross domestic product. And so we're going to have to cut $1 trillion or $2 trillion from the places where you can actually get the money, which is Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. Remember, the budget resolution that the both the House and the Senate passed just about 2 months ago called for $1.5 trillion in cuts, half a trillion dollars in cuts to Medicare, and $1 trillion in cuts to Medicaid. So that's what their agenda is. They're already talking about how they want to enact welfare reform and entitlement reform, and so we are expecting them to come around.
Lastly, I'd ask you this. What is your group and a coalition of organizations across the country doing who oppose this Republican tax reform legislation? What are you all doing in the coming weeks as the House and Senate have this conference committee where they're supposed to negotiate and hammer out a final version of the bill that needs to pass both houses again, the House and Senate?
So the real fight is in the House now, since the Senate, it just passed the Senate, and the House is more likely to take up the Senate bill, which the House has not yet voted on. We're expecting that vote to occur within the next week or so. We have 13 people in the House who voted against the tax bill the first time around, and we need to add 11 people to that. The place to add them are from people who voted against repealing the Affordable Care Act. And there's about 18 people who voted against repealing the Affordable Care Act, 18 members of Congress. So we've got about 13 people who voted against repealing the Affordable Care Act. We need to win 11 of those people. They're in a lot of them are in New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, and California. We would love you to call your representative to make sure that you register your position, which is that you are against the tax bill, the Republican tax bill that will be soon voted on in the House. The phone number to use, our toll-free number, is 877-795-7862.
That was Frank Clemente, Executive Director of Americans for Tax Fairness. Find links to more analysis of the proposed Trump-Republican tax plans and the campaign to defeat the measure by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. At a conference focused on the struggle to rein in and roll back oil and gas infrastructure, more than 300 activists gathered in Pittsburgh, November 17th through the 20th, at the People vs. Oil and Gas Infrastructure Summit for Communities Fighting Back. There they discussed the harms caused by various forms of fossil fuel production and use, including fracking, pipelines, oil trains, LNG export facilities, frack gas power plants, refinery expansion, and more. The current infrastructure boom, summit organizers say, will lock in fossil fuel production for decades to come, threatening the global climate and harming people's air, water, and health. At the summit, activists from across the U.S. who are challenging oil and gas infrastructure projects debated strategies on how to fight back through legal means, direct action, and artistic expression. One of the summit workshops was titled Climate Justice and Jobs and featured two presenters, one from the Service Employees International Union, and Pedro Cruz, senior representative of the Sierra Club's Labor and Economic Justice Program. After the workshop, Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Cruz about the challenges climate activists face in working with labor unions and the critical need to forge closer ties in order to work toward building a clean energy future.
In the U.S., we had two progressive forces, which are the environmental movement and the labor movement. There have been cases in the service sectors, national unions like SEIU, Unite Here, when they march together with environmental activists and the other way around. You have other progressive unions like ATU, that's the transportation union, that basically their claim is that their jobs are green jobs because basically most of the members are bus drivers and work in public transportation. Therefore, they see more investment in public transportation means more job and a cleaner environment. So we had those commonality. Unfortunately, with the building trade, it's kind of like a mixed bag because gas and oil infrastructure is the kind of thing that we're fighting in a day-to-day basis. But my point is we don't have to fight for that. We shouldn't be having that fight. Probably that's an area that we can agree to disagree. Focus also that we also need water infrastructure and the same set of skills that you need to lay down pipe for oil and gas is the same set of skills that you need for water infrastructure. And that's an area that we can be working together. Other area, electrical workers. Electrical workers are the future, basically, of the new economy because electrical workers are the one doing the EV infrastructure, the one doing the retrofit of buildings, the one dealing with the installation of solar energy and wind energy. So there's so many areas where we can be working together. In certain areas, we start to see that partnership, and hopefully it will grow. The renewable sector grow too.
There's way more jobs in renewables than there are, and they're not going to be exported because they need to be done here, than there is in the fossil fuel sector. It's also true, for the most part, that those jobs don't pay nearly as well as jobs, you know, in the coal industry or, you know, in building pipelines. I mean, they sometimes pay like maybe a third as much. And maybe they're mostly not organized, not unionized. Mm-hmm. Do you think the solution to that, is that just to have another whole wave of union organization like happened, you know, in the 1930s, where people in jobs that were not highly skilled jobs still got organized and got decent pay for the work that they do?
I couldn't be more emphatic on my yes, yes, yes. Not only organizing in those sectors, but we, climate defenders, we have such an important role in that organizing process because the same way that we organize boycotting X or Y product because it's bad for the environment, if we can use that same energy to ask for the organizing in the clean energy sector and the renewable sector, it would make such a big impact. We have a lot of bad actors in the clean energy sector, and it's for us also to denounce them and to force them the right thing. I can mention an example of the Nissan plant in Mississippi. They were trying to organize into the union. That plant was supposed to be doing electrical cars that everybody will agree that they are better for the environment than the cars that we have today, but at the same time, those cars are being assembled under condition where the workers are making way less money than other unionized plants in the north part of the country. When you add to that is in Mississippi, in a black and impoverished community, that makes things even worse because it's not just an issue of jobs and an issue of the environment, but it's also an issue of economic justice. Those are the people that should be getting the good jobs of the renewable economy. Those should be the people who should have access to affordable clean energy too. And that's something that we should be advocating for.
That was Pedro Cruz with the Sierra Club's Labor and Economic Justice Program. For more information on labor and environmental collaboration, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. President Trump's appointed chair of the Federal Communications Commission, former Verizon attorney Ajit Pai, has from the beginning of his tenure at the FCC pledged to reverse consumer protections initiated during President Obama's 8 years in office. Now Pai and the Republican majority on the FCC are expected to vote on a resolution to kill net neutrality on December 14th. Net neutrality, which was ratified by the FCC under President Obama in February 2015, prevents big internet service providers like AT&T, Comcast, and Verizon from charging extra fees, engaging in censorship, or controlling what consumers see and do on the web by slowing down or denying access to websites, apps, and other online services. A nationwide protest is planned for December 7th. When activists opposed to the scrapping of net neutrality will demonstrate at Verizon retail stores, demanding that members of Congress take action to stop Trump's FCC from eliminating net neutrality protections. Your reporter spoke with Steven Renderos, organizing director with the Center for Media Justice, whose mission is to address inequities in media access and coverage in diverse communities. Here, Renderos discusses his group's campaign to stop the FCC's plan to repeal net neutrality and explain how repeal would negatively impact internet freedom and the ability of marginalized communities to freely communicate.
The FCC, under the Obama administration, passed these rules in 2015. And under the 2 years that we've had net neutrality as a general law, they've been challenged in court and won, but essentially we've maintained the internet as we've always had it, and in fact has been the strongest set of rules that protect the internet that we've seen anywhere in the world. So it's really like the shining example of the absolute most of what you can do with net neutrality is to treat the internet more like a public utility, because it is for those of us on a day-to-day basis that are using the internet to search for jobs or pay our bills or to search the internet for our education. We experience it more as a utility than we do as a commodity.
Stephen, could you describe for our listeners a bit of the impact of repealing net neutrality on political speech, and in particular for marginalized communities, people of color, people with disabilities, et cetera?
Well, first, the biggest impact is going to be, what is the internet going to look like without net neutrality? And to imagine that, we don't have to step too far away from what we already experience. For those of us who are unfortunately having to pay for cable TV, the experience of paying for access to certain content feels very familiar. You know, when it comes to a pay-per-play internet, your internet service provider is in the driver's seat about what content you can access. And believe me, getting access to the latest protest against Trump for his, you know, the GOP's tax plan, or latest information about the Russia investigation, or the organizing against police violence that Black Lives Matter activists are engaging in, the protests over the Keystone Pipeline, those are not things that are going to rise up to the surface as priorities for a pay-for-play internet. So the things that we depend on to find out about the resistance that is happening under this current administration, would essentially, those voices would be silenced under an internet in which who has the most amount of money gets to determine what content you have access to. It's an internet ecosystem where you have conservatives that are running a lot of the cable TV and news information that we'd see out there. It's a very dangerous, you know, world, and for communities of color in particular, it's a very familiar experience.
You're part of a large coalition, your group, the Center for Media Justice. What is being planned to effectively oppose the move by Donald Trump's FCC
to repeal net neutrality? What can be done both on the grassroots level as well as legal challenges in court to what the FCC has planned?
As much as the chairman of the FCC has demonstrated that he's unwilling to listen to the public, we still feel we have a pretty good shot at saving the internet. So a lot of what you've seen over the last couple weeks is a massive uprising of people generating calls into Congress, because even though the FCC is an independent agency, Congress still oversees the FCC. And so they have a role to play in providing leadership in this moment to demonstrate that we don't want to see net neutrality go away. So since the chairman announced that he was going to move forward on a vote in December to repeal net neutrality, in the last week and a half, 2 weeks, 750,000 calls have gone into Congress. And this is both to hit Democrats and Republicans in Congress. And we've seen a steady stream of Republicans coming out and publicly voicing opposition to what Chairman Pai is trying to do at the FCC. In addition to that, there are a set of nationwide protests that are being organized for Thursday, December 7th, targeting the largest internet service provider in the country, Verizon, who has been actively lobbying to repeal net neutrality. At the same time, there's a legal strategy to this. While our coalition is considering our legal options, including lawsuits after December 14th when the FCC votes, we're also seeing attorney generals stepping in, like in New York. Attorney General Eric Schneiderman is pushing forward a lawsuit, really calling out the fake comments that have come into the FCC from bots and possibly even from Russia, trying to populate the FCC docket with fake comments that support a net neutrality repeal. And tell your friends about this issue. It's vastly important that people know that this is an issue that we could very much lose over the coming weeks. But with people's support and their action, there's a really good chance that we can win.
That was Stephen Renderos, organizing director with the group Center for Media Justice. For more information on the National Coalition Fighting to Save Net Neutrality and related analysis, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WPPP in Athens, Georgia, WHYR in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, KRFY in Sandpoint, Idaho, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.